Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matter show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about the Labour Party, its prospects in May, how well Jeremy Corbyn's doing as leader, and what role the Labour Party will have in the upcoming EU referendum campaign. But first, we'll start, as we traditionally do, with events across the pond. This week, we're going to be talking about the Democrats, so a bit of a break from Donald Trump. Now, last weekend was certainly a good weekend for Bernie Sanders, with victories in Washington State, Alaska and Hawaii. It looks like he's got the momentum behind him, or has he? We'll be talking today a little bit about whether or not we should be taking the senator from Vermont a bit more seriously when it comes to getting the Democrat nomination for president. To discuss some of these issues, I'm joined by Stephen Bush of The New Statesman and Marcus Roberts, International Projects Director at YouGov and also a former staffer at the Labour Party and Democrats. Chaps, welcome.
Thank you.
Marcus, I'll start with you. It certainly seems like shows like these and others have been focusing on Donald Trump in the recent past, maybe for obvious reasons. But, you know, if we look at the Democrat side, there does seem to be something at least going on there. I mean, what do you make of Bernie Sanders' campaign at the moment?
It's a fun campaign. It's an interesting campaign. It's a fun insurgency. It's an interesting insurgency. It won't succeed, and we know the result. We've known the result ever since Super Tuesday. There was a slight question mark when the Michigan result came in such a surprising success for Senator Sanders. But that was immediately course-corrected the following week when Ohio voted for former Senator Clinton. What is very clear is that Hillary Clinton is going to win this nomination. That said, the political effect that Bernie Sanders is having on the Democratic Party is fascinating. Hillary Clinton wants to be running right now against Donald Trump. She is not able to anywhere near the extent she would like to, because she is still having to put down the Sanders insurgency.
Next to the next stage of that being Wisconsin, of course. I mean, how do you see that race playing out? Because presumably if Bernie Sanders was to come away victorious there, and he's not done too badly in the kind of Midwest and the Midwestern states, then maybe, you know, she could be on the back foot a little bit, but you still think it's kind of all over?
Yeah, I do, because Hillary Clinton needs to win far closer to 40% of the remaining delegates to become the nominee. Senator Sanders needs to win far closer to 60% of the remaining delegates to become the nominee. That said, Hillary Clinton always has her superdelegates in her back pocket. These are members of Congress, senators, senior Democratic Party officials who also have voting rights in the contest. Throughout this contest, there's been a clear pattern. Bernie Sanders has done better in caucus states. Hillary Clinton has done better in primary states. The overwhelming majority of Democratic voters participate in these contests in primaries rather than caucuses. The three victories that we saw for Senator Sanders the other day were all in caucus states. This was to be fairly expected. Now, it's an interesting question as to why Senator Sanders does better there and why Hillary Clinton does worse there. But that's an interesting question that doesn't actually affect the outcome. Because if this pattern holds, or indeed, given the insurance of the superdelegates, any number of other factors hold sway, it's pretty clear to me that Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee, even if it takes a little bit more time. Probably all the way up until June the 7th and the final primary day up in big states like California. It'll probably take her that long, but in the end, I'm pretty sure she'll be the nominee.
I mean, Stephen, I want to get your perspective on the campaign. It certainly felt like back in last autumn, maybe last summer, that everyone was assuming that Bernie Sanders was kind of along for the ride, but ultimately would be dealt with quite quickly. Hillary Clinton doesn't seem to have been able to put him out of the race, at least, very early on. I mean, what's your assessment on why that might have been?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. I mean, one... He has been put out of the race. He was decisively put out of the race on Super Tuesday. There is no evidence that he has managed to win over African-American voters, without which you cannot be the nominee.
And Hispanics.
He hasn't been able to... he has not managed to make inroads into those crucial parts of the Democratic coalition. However, just as with Clinton against Obama, when it was actually apparent at about this point in the cycle, and don't forget that Clinton has a larger delegate lead over Sanders than Obama ever had over her in the last race. But there were regions in which she was stronger, where she couldn't quite be put out of contention, and she also was able to keep going until the end, although she was mathematically certain of defeat from earlier on. I mean, in some ways, actually, it's a kind of classic example of do unto others. She would have a far stronger argument for saying, look, I've won that's not a matter of politics, it's a matter of maths. Do me a favour, do the party a favour and get out. If she had done the party a favour and got out in 2008, which arguably she should have done. I mean, John McCain was a far more formidable opponent than Donald Trump. So the argument for letting Obama have a clear run at it was much stronger. But the big problem is there's always been Clinton fatigue among one particular section of the Democratic electorate, white liberal, in fact, white voters in general. And they've wanted another candidate. My instinct is if Sanders hadn't run, then Martin O'Malley might have got a bit further down the track before hitting against exactly the same problem. And, you know, African-Americans and Hispanics do not have the same Clinton disillusionment that white voters do. So Clinton fatigue was never a factor. And it's really... The success of Sanders, I think, is only maybe a third down to his message and 60% down to the weaknesses of Clinton as a candidate, not taking away from her qualifications for the role, but she's been around a long time. There is, you know, it is a legacy that, you know, some people like and some people feel more conflicted about.
And she's run a smarter campaign, too. It is really clear from the staff that she's picked, people like Robbie Mook, her campaign manager, these are people who tend to be more in their mid to late 30s rather than their 50s and 60s, as the kind of gang that she ran with last time. And these people are more digital savvy, more field operations friendly, and more delegate math oriented. And that means that even when she loses these caucus states, she doesn't lose them so badly in delegate terms. And this is always her ace in the hole, because she can continue to win, she can continue to lose caucus states, but keep the gap narrow enough that the primary wins that she makes, as demonstrated just the other day when she won big, big, big in Florida and Ohio, meant that she can continue to grow her lead.
I mean, what do you see the role for Bernie Sanders being in the party in the future? Because, I mean, I suppose one argument says that he just disappears after he fails to win the nomination. You know, he gives a very nice concession speech, one would imagine, and passes, well, maybe not passes the torch, but at least endorses Hillary Clinton, much as she did with President Obama when he was successful. I mean, having said that, do you think that his continued involvement in the race will help to drag Hillary Clinton to the left, dare I say, and maybe get some of his agenda across, maybe on campaign finance reform or on other things?
Sure. I think that he will have an effect in giving Hillary excuses to do things that she wanted to do anyway. There's no appetite in the Clinton campaign to prevent campaign finance reform from going forward. There's a problem in terms of lacking a Democratic Congress to make that happen. That's the impediment is not with the Clintons, actually. More interestingly, though, is what is the long-term effect in the Democratic Party of an anti-globalization candidate like Bernie Sanders. And it is really telling that both the Republican Party in the form of Donald Trump and the Democrats with Bernie Sanders are now experiencing serious blowback against globalization on behalf of a lot of white working class voters who feel that they've been left behind by industrialization, mechanization, cheap foreign labor, decline of trade unions and other factors. And a lot of liberal white voters, as Stephen is referring to, are casting their votes accordingly in the Democratic Party, even as in the Republican Party, a lot of these people who are feeling very angry are going themselves for Donald Trump. So that is going to have an effect on the Democrats as well as the Republicans. And both are going to probably in the long term have to adjust the way they approach free trade issues. And that will have serious effects for what a President Clinton is like.
I want to come back to, or close to home, and sort of look at those comparisons between Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn in a minute. But Stephen, before I do, I mean, one of the things that I remember when President Obama was the candidate Obama, there was a lot of speculation about whether Hillary Clinton supporters would turn out for him in the general election. And I guess maybe it's an inevitable consequence of a two-horse race such as this. People are starting to speculate about Bernie Sanders' supporters and whether they'll turn out for Hillary in November. I mean, I guess common sense suggests that the presence of a candidate Trump is probably all you need to get these people to turn out. But, I mean, do you think she should be worried about turning out these Bernie bros and all these other sorts of people?
No. There will be a handful of people, and just with they were Pumas, Party Unity My Arse is what they called themselves, and they said they would only vote for Clinton, they wouldn't vote for Obama. There'll be a handful of people who will write some very shrill articles in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, saying, oh, you know, it's Bernie or bust. But even some of the people who write those articles will privately cast a ballot to stop the global catastrophe of a Trump or, indeed, any Republican presidency. And the ones who don't will be people who live in places like, you know, Susan Sarandon. I mean, to be honest, I don't think the Democrats are going to lose New York with or without the vote of Susan Sarandon.
Donald Trump thinks so. Donald Trump thinks a lot of things, yeah. I guess. Let's bring it close to home then. I'll go back to you again, Stephen. I mean, one of the comparisons people make when they look at what's going on in the UK and what's going on in the US is this comparison between Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. And I suppose, you know, cosmetically at least, there are obvious comparisons in terms of their age and maybe the fact they've been around a long time and hold certain views that they've held for a long time and that sort of thing. So I suppose it's not that surprising that comparisons are made. But how closely aligned do you see sort of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn as candidates? I mean, do you think they're very similar, or do you think it's an over-egged...
I'm always very sceptical about read-acrosses between American and British politics, other than through the art of method. If you want to know how to run a good field campaign, a good digital campaign, look to America. If you want to understand trends, you're much better off looking across to Europe. I mean, Sanders actually... in some ways, is running as a more Corbyn-style figure than he is. He's presenting himself as someone who has never moderated his views, but he has. I mean, look at his record on gun control. That's not because Sanders is a committed gun nut. He's actually the most liberal on guns you can be and still get elected in Vermont. But the "and still get elected in Vermont" is a fairly important part. Jeremy Corbyn has never moderated his views to get elected, ever. Yeah, he is a much more principled, a very different calibre of left-wing insurgent to Bernie Sanders. The other big difference is Corbyn's big obstacle is, could he get 301 when boundary changes come in, seats in the House of Commons to actually implement his agenda. But although you may have objections to that agenda, it's not unworkable. Sanders is running on a ticket that even if he won every state in a landslide, there are not 60 votes in the Senate to break a filibuster. There is not a congressional majority for any of the Sanders agenda. Yeah, so it's, you know, you have one guy who is running on an agenda people fear is unelectable and who has been radical all his life. And you have someone who has been a Vermont left winger who is running on a platform that is unimplementable. Well, yeah, I think the differences between them are much bigger than the similarities.
I mean, Marcus, I suppose if you're being unkind, you will say that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders never likely to be elected as heads of their respective governments anyway. But I mean, do you share Stephen's assessment of the differences and similarities between the candidates?
Very much so. Their biggest similarity is, just as you say, that neither is at all likely to ever be capable of winning a general election. What is interesting is the extent to which both the Democratic and the Labour parties have decided that that isn't important anymore. And so perhaps there's a phenomenon that we can study in those parties, and or indeed in Germany's SPD or in the French Socialists, with regard to left-wing parties deciding that they don't care about power anymore. And that could be something that we could read across. But to the extent that there's big lessons to be learned between Jeremy Corbyn, a man who thinks that the use of force in any circumstances, possibly even including the Second World War, is incorrect, and Bernie Sanders, who does believe that there are such things as just wars, who hasn't proposed closing the Pentagon down, and who says that President Obama has been by and large right on his national security decision-making. Those are big differences between those candidates.
I guess another similarity, though, is they both seem to, almost counterintuitively, given their age, get a lot of support from young people, maybe a certain type of young activist, but that seems to be a similarity across them too. And what does that say about young people and their engagement in politics, do you think?
It is another big difference between them both, that Jeremy Corbyn was able to successfully change the nature of the Labour Party's electorate. An order of magnitude that was, quite frankly, unimaginable to people, I would probably think that even Stephen and myself going into last summer's contest. Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, has not been able to do that. Yes, he's got some young people very excited and very angry, but he hasn't got a large enough number of them. Jeremy Corbyn, on the other hand, has managed to tap into something far bigger and more powerful, at least in terms of his ability to capture the Labour Party and its politics for a while. And that is because of his support amongst young people and also amongst other voters. I'm sure Stephen can say more
about
that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, the idea that Corbynism is confined to the young, I think, is something of a misread. I mean, it was Socially concerned baby boomers are still the largest block of members in the Labour Party. Only about a fifth of Labour members are young. Members of Young are qualified to join Young Labour. And Jeremy won a clear victory among basically every type of Labour member. He is not a demographically limited candidate within the context of Labour, whereas Bernie Sanders very much is a demographically limited candidate. I think then the interesting similarity between them is in general this graduate without a future, someone who has found themselves shut off from the housing ladder, is in a slightly more precarious job than they would have expected to be, feels weighed down by debt. But where the big difference is if you are an American graduate, you are genuinely weighed down by debt. That is debt which can lead to someone knocking at your door and getting the money back from you. If you are weighed down by debt in a British sense, you have a higher marginal tax rate than you would like.
And you're referring to Sanders' signature policy of free college education.
Of free college education. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different economic pressure point. I think the similarities are overstated.
I mean, I was going to split this show into two parts, but I think we might as well just carry on into the second segment, because this does lead us nicely into what we were going to talk about in part two, which is the Labour Party and their prospects in May. There was a relatively good poll, or it was perceived as such, by Jeremy Corbyn's supporters, conducted by Ipsos Mori recently, which seemed to suggest that Jeremy Corbyn's, we got it here, his satisfaction ratings were better than David Cameron. So if we look at the net satisfaction rating, which is the difference between those satisfied and those dissatisfied, David Cameron minus 25, Jeremy Corbyn on minus 11, Nigel Farage on minus 2, Tim Farron on minus 12. That obviously, the comparison that's perhaps most important there is the one between the two party leaders. I mean, Stephen, this will be something of a flip, if you like, for Corbyn supporters. They certainly hold this up as an example of their man doing well.
Yeah, I mean, superficially, it will look like, to lots of people, a poll which shows Corbyn closing the gap with Cameron, dispelling the idea that he is unelectable, quote-unquote. I personally don't like the satisfied-dissatisfied question. I know it's an open debate within the polling community. I much prefer approve-disapprove because, I mean, Nigel Farage, we know from almost every other bit of data, is not the least unpopular politician in Britain, which is what that poll would suggest. Satisfied is very different. If you are someone who wants UKIP to do badly, you are probably very satisfied with Nigel Farage's conduct as leader of UKIP, where he has expelled one of their most terrifying weapons, if you are one of UKIP's opponents, in the shape of Suzanne Evans, exiled another to the wilderness in the shape of Patrick O'Flynn. I mean, if you are an anti-UKIP politician, you are pretty damn satisfied with Nigel Farage. And ditto, I mean, if you are a Labour partisan, you're pretty satisfied with George Osborne's conduct as Chancellor of the Exchequer lately. And so until I see an approve-disapprove figure, I'm not going to break out the bunting one way or the other, because, yeah, I am really dubious about satisfied-dissatisfied.
Totally agree. I mean, to get really nerdy about it, we could say that that approve-disapprove doesn't really get us to where we want to go. What you need to ask is, who do you want as Prime Minister? Because that at that point, you cut away from all of the false noise that you hear of Conservatives saying that they're delighted to see Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party, and all of the other examples that Stephen just gave.
I mean, another example would be Tim Farron's ratings, satisfied 24%, dissatisfied 36%. Obviously a large body of don't-knows there, but if you just mechanically look at the net rating, then it sort of implies a sort of degree of popularity, whereas actually no one's really heard of him because the Lib Dems are out of the news, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that what this graphic tells us that is really important to take away from is, don't get too excited reading too many clever tea leaves of, if we cut the question this way, doesn't it look good for us? Mm-hmm. Go back to the fundamentals. And this, if anything, is what election 2015 should have taught us. Because if we hadn't been looking at voter party identification, the top line headline numbers of the horse race, and we had instead concentrated on, who do people rate as Prime Minister, who do people rate as Chancellor, who do they trust with running the economy, where do the party stand on the big issues of immigration and welfare, we would have all been able to correctly predict a Conservative government, if not a Conservative majority indeed. The problem was, we all got very clever, didn't we? And we started looking at the data like this, and the more finely tuned we tuned the data, the less actually we knew about what politics was really telling us.
I mean, Stephen, you were one of the earliest people to, if not the first, to tap into Jeremy Corbyn's surge as in the leadership contest last summer. I mean, when we look ahead to May, what's a good May for Jeremy Corbyn in terms of his leadership of the Labour Party? Or does it even matter?
I mean, I think there are sort of two questions. There's one, what does he need to do in order to remain leader of the Labour Party? And I would say he needs to avoid heavy losses, so more than 100 councillors, and to hold on to London. And anything else which happens is fine. It may be very difficult for Labour to pass legislation in the Welsh Assembly, but the First Minister in Wales will still be a Labour politician, and that will really be all anyone outside of Wales cares about. You can argue that shouldn't be the case, but that is, unfortunately, the way that Wales is covered in the rest of the United Kingdom. In terms of what he would need to be posting in order to be on a trajectory to win, he really does need to be looking to gain 300 to 400 council seats. Labour is still at a baseline, you know, below where it was at the point before the financial crisis. And when Blair was at the bottom of his unpopularity, you know, when he was sort of hanging on as a kind of zombie, yeah, Labour really ought to be picking up, you know, 200, 300, 400 council seats to be in a position where it can confidently say, yes, actually, we might be able to displace the Tories in 2020.
I mean, Marcus, we were talking off air about London, weren't we, and how, you know, it feels like if there is going to be a smoking gun that might shift members' opinions, I don't even know if that smoking gun exists, to be honest, but if there was going to be one, then Zach Goldsmith being elected London mayor might be it. I mean, what's your assessment of May and what Jeremy Corbyn needs to do?
I think that the Labour Party has largely priced in a Sadiq Khan victory in London. And one of the reasons it's done that is because Sadiq Khan is running a very strong, very successful campaign that has absolutely nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn. If you look more broadly in the country, and maybe we can put a link up on the site to this, I wrote a piece for the Times Redbox a couple of months ago, looking just historically at what a good result would be for the Labour Party in these elections, or indeed a historically average result. It's pretty clear that the Labour Party, and indeed any opposition party, going all the way back to 1974, which is really when you can do local government election comparisons from, the opposition party always makes gains in local council elections. There have been only two exceptions to this, and those exceptions occurred when this country was in a state of war and the opposition party was in the process of melting down and forming a different party in the form of the SDP and the Falklands crisis. So it is extremely difficult to find any historical examples of an opposition not making gains on the government. And so if something that Stephen said were to happen, and the Labour Party were to end up losing a net number of councillors, even as many as an extraordinary number, 100, that would be remarkable. It's far, far, far more likely in terms of what history has to teach us that Labour should be making something like 300 to 400 gains. Mm. Corbyn can probably get by with just 200 to 300 gains, but below that, people are going to ask some serious questions. Then comes Scotland, then comes Wales.
But then, Stephen, I mean, isn't part of the fundamental problem that this is all well and good? I mean, maybe Jeremy Corbyn does have an absolute disaster in May that everyone can objectively agree to. But ultimately, it's the views of the membership that's got to change for him to genuinely be in trouble, isn't it?
Well, yes. But I think one of the things we've overstated when we look at polls of the membership, and they say, oh, we aren't interested in winning an election. One, we all remember how the psychology of many people in the Labour Party changed during the European elections. That very long night for people in the Labour Party when they were third throughout much of the evening.
And then
And it was only when London came in that they were able to just inch ahead of the Conservatives. And the number of Miliband loyalists who said to me afterwards, do you know what, I really don't think we can make it. It's one thing to say to a pollster, I don't care about winning elections. They've just lost an election with a candidate who they didn't feel shared their values. They now have someone who they are in tune with. It's one thing to go, I don't care if I lose. It's a bit like going, oh, I don't care if I break my arm doing this bungee jump. You hit the ground and you suddenly do care about breaking your arm. The big difference is that other than Sadiq or the loss of a lot of councillors, it's not really personal for the members. My instinct is that there probably will come a shift if the electoral signs are as bad as many fear they will be. And that will be, just as it was last time, in different European elections in 2019.
You brought up the European elections, and I suppose we've got the most important European election coming up, that being the EU referendum. If we look at some of the polling around this, I've been looking at the what UK thinks EU, which is something that John Curtis runs, which I'm sure many listeners and viewers will be familiar with. And he takes a sort of rolling polling average of the past six polls and has Remain on 53, Leave on 47. But underneath the skin of some of this polling data is are some interesting findings. I was looking at some Ipsos Mori data again, which showed Remain ahead 8 points, but actually once you start factoring in turnout, and I want to come on to turnout actually because I think it's quite important, the lead is down to 2 points. I mean, Marcus, what's your assessment of the current state of the EU referendum campaign and Labour's role within it?
There is no path to Brexit that doesn't go through Labour voters. Roughly, let's presume that there are 20 million people taking part in this referendum. 8 million of them are going to vote Remain, pretty much come what may. 8 million of them are going to vote Leave, pretty much come what may. 4 million of them are undecided. Who are those undecideds? They're disproportionately Labour voters. They're often white working class voters. They're often employed women voters. They're often voters who are concerned about immigration but are more concerned about the economy. And this is ground zero for the referendum. If anything, I think that that 26% number for Labour voters who back Leave is probably a little bit low. It's probably more like a third are currently
Leave. Let's call that out for those that might be listening in. So we looked at Labour voters versus not Labour voters. And Labour voters, it says 68% Remain, 26% Leave, not Labour voters, 42% Remain, 51% Leave, implying if there was a universe where Labour voters all just took the day off, then Leave would win.
Sure. It is pretty important to understand that unless the Remain campaign can pull back some of these sort of Labour UKIP switchers, as well as reassure some of these genuine Labour don't knows, for whom this referendum has very little salience, and who are being asked to go to the polls once in May and then again in June, which is a big ask. As an ex-field organiser, I can tell you it's hard enough to get a person to come out once every 5 years for a general election, never mind twice within 2 months for local elections and then a referendum. This is a really big nut to crack for the Remain campaign.
I mean, Steve, when we look at Jeremy Corbyn's role in this, there's been some criticism of him that he's been very, very quiet. You know, in fact, that he feels like as quiet as he's been since he's become leader. I mean, what do you assess his role in this campaign to be? Some people say that he's actually a sort of closet Brexiter, and that's why he's shut up, because he knows that really to come out and say that would be that smoking gun that might be detrimental to his leadership ambitions. I mean, what does he do between now and the referendum?
I mean, I think that is the big test. We are frequently told that he has changed his mind on Europe, and then some of his allies will privately point to his skill in managing to reassure the membership he's their guy on it. You know, they say, look at how Cameron has managed to bruise the feelings of his grassroots, and look at how Jeremy has reassured his. My read is that Jeremy Corbyn is still very much a Eurosceptic, would prefer Britain to leave the European Union, and then by staying relatively quiet, he probably can help secure that outcome. If, however, I'm wrong and he has genuinely experienced this massive conversion, the only real conversion of Jeremy Corbyn's political life, then he can play a big role, because we know Labour voters are the ball game. And even though he is not that popular even among Labour voters, we know leader effects matter. And so he can have a decisive role. But my instinct is he will play a decisive role by sitting on his hands.
And if he had changed his mind genuinely, he would have shown up and on the all-hands-on-deck Labour Party campaigning day for Europe, instead of going, as he did, to address the CND rally instead.
And if you were part of the Remain campaign, I mean, how worried would you be right now? I mean, I think that there is still this underlying assumption that ultimately the status quo has an inbuilt advantage in any referenda, and in this case that will be the case as well. But then when we look at the Tories in disarray, almost split down the middle on this issue, and Labour almost seemingly sitting this out, then if you're someone that supports the Remain campaign, you presumably are quite worried.
Oh, yes. Britain is fundamentally a small-C conservative country and is not prone to making big political changes easily. That is Remain's great strategic advantage in all of this. That said, if Leave succeeds in making the argument that remaining in the European Union is a risk, if Leave succeeds in making this an argument about a stronger economy for Britain outside of the European Union than Britain within the European Union. And if Remain can manage the immigration question so that it isn't all about Nigel Farage, let's throw the foreigners out style politics, and becomes much more about sovereignty is important, controlling our nation's decisions is important, controlling our borders is important, then Leave has a bunch of winning arguments there. And what does Remain have to counter it? It has that original proposition we returned to, that Britons don't like to make big changes. But that's putting a lot of pressure on one argument.
Hmm. Stephen, I think I remember rightly, one of your early New Year predictions was that you thought Britain might vote to leave the European Union. Is that a view that you still share? And if not, why not? And if so, why?
I mean, I think it's still far, you know, I made that prediction on the basis that there would be some form of migrant crisis, which I think does decisively tip the terrain in favour of Leave. It makes Remain seem like a much riskier option. I mean, ignoring the fact that actually that you have a migrant crisis, whether or not you're in or out of the European Union, that is not how it will feel. Ultimately,
it's the perception that ultimately matters, right?
Ultimately, is there going to be a resolution to the migrant crisis by June the 23rd? No. And I think that means that the odds on Leave should be much, much, much narrower than they are.
Do you share that, Marcus? I suppose, you know, to what extent do you think the migrant crisis is priced in? It's almost something happening in the background. Or do you agree with Stephen that actually this is something that could motivate people to think, actually, the less safe option is remaining, I'm going to vote for Brexit?
Absolutely, providing that the Leave campaign don't actually campaign on that issue. The easiest way for the Leave campaign to ruin this for themselves is to make a big song and dance of immigration as an issue, because that will in turn turn off a lot of very reasonable voters who are concerned about this issue, immigration, for both cultural as well as economic reasons, but who don't want under any circumstances to be branded as racist. So if there is a ton of opprobrium around the immigration issue that Leave is making the center point of their campaign, they are not going to want to be associated with that, and thus they'll vote with economic security rather than with concerns about immigration.
And the subject of today's discussion was Labour, and I want to come back to, in closing, come back to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. I mean, there is this speculation, is there not, that there will be some kind of challenge after the EU referendum campaign in this kind of window between conference and the result of the EU referendum. I mean, do you think that's likely? And if so, you know, how likely do you think it is to succeed? I'll throw that open to Stephen.
I think it's probably an 80% chance of it happening, and probably...
What does the leadership challenge look like? I mean, are we talking about names on a ballot and someone versus Corbyn in September?
I mean, I think then there will probably be someone who will fly a kite, who will do some kind of article going, the time for leadership is now. The question then is, does someone decide to walk the plank from the shadow cabinet? My guess is that the most likely scenario is someone resigns, they call for more resignations, there aren't any. Someone else detonates publicly.
Pernell Miliband scenario.
Yeah. But yeah, I think there is very little chance of that coup succeeding. I think there is a fairly high chance, because this is really the only set of midterms we have in this parliament. There aren't very many elections in 2017. There aren't very many in 2018. There may not be European Parliament elections in 2019. there are people who are saying we've got to act, and we've got to act now, and they will act. However, they still don't have a candidate they can all agree on. They still don't have unity within the shadow cabinet and those who have decided not to serve. And Jeremy Corbyn is still the favourite candidate of the membership. If I were Jeremy Corbyn, the only person who would keep me awake at night in terms of my job was John McDonnell.
Do you agree, Marcus? I mean, it feels like, you know, if anything, if there was a sort of botched coup attempt against Jeremy Corbyn, he could emerge in September stronger than ever before, at least amongst the Labour Party membership.
That's very much the case. And there is one gigantic factor that will really assist Jeremy Corbyn in holding onto his job this summer, and that is momentum. And I don't mean momentum in terms of the leftist organisation. I mean momentum in terms of any momentum for a coup immediately in the wake of, let us presume to say, in this scenario, bad election results for Labour in May, will be dissipated by the fact that no one will want to mount a coup until after the European referendum result. So you're actually having to hold in your head to believe that a coup is possible or indeed probable. The idea that, yes, the results will be bad in May, yes, they will be so bad that the PLP will want to have a coup, and yes, they will be so bad that the PLP will want to have a coup, and at the same time have the patience to wait another 7 or 8 weeks until after they've got rid of the European referendum, and then gone back to the feelings of emotion that they felt of Sturm und Drang the 7 weeks previously. And if you put all of that together, it's very easy to see how momentum actually for any coup could well dissipate.
I mean, just in closing, I mean, lots of people that watch this show and listen to the podcast will be political bettors, hence it goes on politicalbetting.com. Are there any people within the Labour Party that these people should be looking at in terms of potential next leaders? Or do you think actually it's a case of, you know, Corbyn's there in 2020, come what may? Stephen, what do you think? You mentioned John McDonnell.
I think that there are two bets that I would make for Labour's leader in 2020. One is Jeremy himself, one is John McDonnell. I find it hard to see beyond those two lists, and I think if you're betting on people afterwards, my guess is that the sweet spot to be is the politician to furthest Jeremy's right, but who can most credibly say, I was loyal, I was in the trenches, I worked very hard, I did my job. Who are the politicians on the right of the Labour Party in the shadow cabinet who are properly putting their noses to the grindstone and who are not causing any trouble? There are three of them.
Andy Burnham's third time lucky campaign.
There are four of them. I'm not counting Andy Burnham. There's Andy Burnham, there's Heidi Alexander, there's John Ashworth, and there's Chris Bryan. And I think if any of them decided to run after a 2020 defeat, they would be a much more formidable candidate than their betting odds currently suggest.
Well, very interesting. Thanks very much, Stephen. And thanks to Marcus for your time. That's all we've got time for this week's politicalbetting.com Polling Matters show. A big thanks to my guests once again. Join us next week when we'll be talking about the London mayoral election, which could very much be that smoking gun that causes problems for Jeremy Corbyn.